attracting and engaging highly affluent clients requires a special set of skills. You need to understand their particular needs and expectations. While some can be overly demanding, if you earn their trust and respect, they can be some of the most loyal clients you can have. In this episode of the podcast, Gail Dobie talks to Klaus Baer of WRJ Interiors. Learn why the firm chose Jackson Hole, Wyoming as their base of operations and the unique challenges of working with affluent clients.
Klaus, it is so great to see you. And it has been so many years since we've known each other. And I've watched you and Rush grow through such big changes. And I'm very excited to talk about that today. So in this episode, let's start with talking about your firm. How many are on your team? Where are you located? A little bit about it.
Sure. Well, I'll just say as well, Gail, it's a pleasure to be here. And I'm honored to be a guest on your podcast. Congratulations on the success. And we go back 11 years, if anybody's counting, and I am. We go back to 2013. So I give a lot of credit to all of the advice you gave us at the outset. But we, when we started with you that many years ago, we probably had 6 or 7 people. Now we're 25.
Oh, my gosh. You have grown a lot.
We've grown.
That's crazy.
A lot of peeps.
And you're located in Jackson Hole.
We're in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And you haven't gotten to any other locations yet.
No, we've talked about it, but we wanted to get the base going here first. So right now we're just in Jackson.
Okay, great.
Working nationally, but headquarters in Jackson.
Wonderful. Well, how did you start your firm?
So our firm has got a little bit of an interesting background. I'll try to make this as concise as I can. But my partner and husband, Rush Jenkins, and I run the company. And he actually technically founded it in 2003. Back in New York City when we were both living there. And he had been the director of design at Sotheby's Auction House, their headquarters offices in New York. He had been in that role for years and then went out and started WRJ, which are his initials, William Rush Jenkins. And he had been doing a lot of exhibition work with Sotheby's for single owner sales and collections for the likes of the Kennedy Family Homes and Katharine Hepburn and Cher and some really notable people that would be recognizable names. But then when he left and started WRJ, he really began to branch more into interior design for residential work. And even though before all that, he had gotten his background in landscape architecture at Cal Poly in California, and then got a graduate degree at Sotheby's London. It was really when he launched in 2003 and started doing this interior work for residential that he really, I think his passion really started to come out. We met in 2000 and I was starting to help him with some of his projects, just whenever I had time. I had no formal training in design at that time. I was working at Bear Stearns and before that I had been at Goldman Sachs. I was not a banker, but I was in the support side of the bank. So I was more involved with the operations and dealt with marketing teams and, you know, HR and all of the things that help any company run. So as we began to work more and more together in those early 2000s, I ultimately decided that I wanted to work with Rush. And he's like, well, you're not going to work with me unless you have formal training in design. So I went to Parsons at night while I was working at Bear Stearns and got my graduate degree. And then when they went down in 08, when the big recession hit, we joined forces full time formally. So it was at that time that I really... Our roles, I guess, became much more defined. So I really, even though I had a design degree, really got into the operation of the company and really tried to make sure that we had processes in place, which is one of the things you hammered into our heads, when we met. But I always felt like, you know, to have the architecture of the company well structured would help the literal metaphor of, you know, doing architectural design and interior design be more fluid and be more seamless and more hopefully free from errors, the better. So that was why I think we worked from the beginning really well together. He had his role in design and I had my role in the operations.
How did you end up in Jackson Hole?
We ended up in Jackson Hole for a variety of reasons. My background was a little bit more Austrian and European influence, as well as the North Georgia Mountains. My father is from Austria, and so I spent a lot of time growing up there. So I love the mountains. Rush grew up on a farm outside of Idaho Falls, which is about 2 hours west of Jackson. So he used to come over to Jackson as a young boy and just loved it. You know, it's such a great, for anyone who's been here, it's such a beautiful valley. It's such a great, charming town. So that left an indelible mark on his memory from all those years ago. So we were finishing a really notable project for the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California in about 2008 or nine. And we were kind of at this pivot point. I'd been in New York at that point by almost about 13 years. Rush had been there for 10 almost. And we both were in our mid-40s. We were not spring chickens. And we were trying to figure out where we wanted to live and develop this company that we were starting to build for the next, you know, 20 years, 15, 20 years. And we loved New York. We loved a lot of things about New York, but we didn't want to live there for the next 20 years. We wanted to live in a place like where we are to be able to enjoy our life and also hopefully have a successful business. And the other answer to your question about why Jackson Hole is back in 2009 or so when we were thinking about it, we recognized that there seemed to be a little bit of a, I don't want to sound like a snobby here, but it seemed like there was a little bit of a deficit of a more international influence of design. It had up to that point been very, I would say, traditional in the sense of, you know, that Western aesthetic. And we felt like we could bring a different approach to living in the mountains, living beautifully in the West, but with an elevated sensibility of aesthetic. So we thought that there was an opportunity there. And with that, we just decided to kind of literally jump feet first. We did not have one single client. We didn't know a soul. And we just had a lot of faith and a lot of hard work. So we started and hired our first employee in 2011 and a second one later that year. And then just slowly, you know, slowly started to grow. And we met you in 2013. So we had been in a, you know, business for a couple of years out here, but then you really helped us begin to move things forward. So that was how we landed out here.
Wow. That is such a cool story. So you have ended up doing very, very ultra affluent work. And I know that's not typical for most firms, but you've ended up there partly because the people that are attracted to Jackson Hole tend to be very wealthy people that are looking for that incredible mountain lifestyle. So was that your intent to begin working with ultra affluent, or did that just happen because of where you are?
I think our first intent was just to put food on the table.
That's a good
one. To be honest, I think I remember, because this is now, gosh, 13 years ago. I definitely remember evaluating the clientele that we thought would be here. We looked at a few of the other big towns, you know, Sun Valley and Aspen and some of the other mountain towns that we really liked. And we felt like Jackson just had this rising caliber of people. And I love Aspen. We're actually doing projects there, but we have seen over the years, there's a difference between here and there. And these are probably the two, I would say, most expensive real estate markets. Aspen seems to be a little bit more like visible. People like to have kind of that visibility. Whereas Jackson, people like it to be a little bit more under the radar. It's shifting. I think since COVID things are shifting. But the clientele are, you know, they're definitely affluent. There's a lot of affluence here. And at the same time, really kind people. We've been very lucky over the years to work with some incredibly kind and wonderful people. So did we seek out the ultra affluent? I wouldn't say that. I think what we sought out first is what I said earlier, which was people or clientele who had an appreciation for high quality materials, fine craftsmanship, a really high attention to detail. Mm-hmm. And we have found that to be certainly the case here. And I think that goes kind of hand in hand with someone who's typically successful and fluent. They're usually successful for a reason. Part of that is they pay attention to details and quality and craftsmanship. I think those are interwoven.
Mm, okay. What are some of the challenges with breaking into this level of work?
Well, it's interesting when I looked back at the thought, thinking about this a little bit. And, you know, one of the advantages I think that Rush brought to his company, our company, you know, that he started first, but our company now together, is when he was working at Sotheby's, he had a lot of training and experience working with, I mean, the top of the top type of luminaries, such as Nancy Reagan. He worked personally with her on an exhibition that we did for her at the Reagan Library. He worked with Baroness Rothschild out of France. He worked with Lily Safra of Safra Bank. I mean, these are, you can't really get much higher than some of these folks. And he really had to develop a polish for just how to interrelate to these folks and how to deliver the design and articulate the design. So it was a really interesting training ground, in my opinion, not to certainly minimize that word. So when we started to work with and find ourselves working with a lot of these clients that were on that level of certainly of affluence, you know, they have expectations of deliverables. They have expectations of exactitude of craftsmanship. They have expectations of, you know, get this project done, be on target, and keep it on track. So all of those things, for someone who is younger, I would say, and not as experienced, maybe that's in their 20s or certainly they're learning in their 30s. But I think that there's a lot to be said, especially in this industry and especially working with, you know, high-level clientele. There's a lot that comes with just plain old experience and time in the saddle, right? Yeah, I think just speaking from my own experience with watching my partner, Rush, work with clients at a very high level, one of the things that, or a couple of the things and factors that I think help him to be successful is helping clients make decisions, like when we need to move something forward. At the same time, he has a wicked sense of humor. So he can bring a levity to things when perhaps, you know, the spouses aren't agreeing on something. You almost have to become a psychologist for a minute. So he's able to lighten the mood, try to help each other see each other's points of view and move things forward. And that comes with just years of being in the saddle, in my opinion, and gaining that experience just doing it.
I just chuckle when you say in the saddle, because you are in the West. I remember, I just have to say this, it's a little bit off the track here, but I remember being up on one of the hills close by, and I looked up and there was a street sign that said, "Whoa."
Yeah. Actually, it's still there. It's going over to it is. And it's just like, nonstop. Oh.
Jackson just cracks me up. All right. So getting back to the topic, I think you hit on a really important part of his, I think it's his persona, but his ability to come across with such grace and ease in the way that he speaks. And he's also, it's very clear he's very smart. So I think he relates to the people that he's serving so well, because he's a businessman too, and you're running a very, very successful business. So I think he has definitely honed those skills, and you have the same ones. You're both just amazing with people. Love to watch.
We enjoy that. That's definitely a part of the job that we really love. We love working with, we just love working with people. I'm actually moving more and more over to really focusing on new business, which I love to do. But I was reflecting a little bit, Gail, on the question of what the ultra affluent really want. And I made a few notes to myself, because as the more I've thought about it, I think it kind of boiled down to two or three common things that no matter who is listening, or whether you're an interior designer, you're an architect, you're a builder, you're any industry where you're working with this really affluent clientele, to me, it seems to boil down over and over and over to these few factors. And one is, first and foremost, trust, and developing a level of trust. And that's why I think you see a lot of times a designer will get asked, repeat project for a client. Like, once that bond is there, they really trust you. Clients very typically going to ask you to move forward to the next home. But trust is first and foremost. Make things easy for them. They typically don't have a lot of time. They may fly in on their private jet or whatever, and they sometimes just need to get in, have a meeting, and get out. So time is something that I have seen that they really value. In fact, we had one client even say to us, Rush asked him, like, what is it about having a private jet for you that is so meaningful or valuable? Because it's not cheap, obviously. And he said, honestly, it's time. He had a big family, and his ability to go to all of his kids, you know, college games or events or whatever for him was a big deal. And so he can afford it. And so time for him was very important. And the third thing is have fun. You know, it needs to, we're building homes. You know, this is something that's very intimate and personal, but there should be certainly a level of fun and levity to it. So I think that's one thing Rush does very well is, and I know that anyone who's in design business, they have to be able to do this to be successful. That's part of the allure of, you know, this whole interaction that I think people hire us for. So to me, that's the third of three really important factors.
Well, and I do believe the personality is important as well, because there is either a click or there isn't. So there has to be chemistry in that relationship. And that's true no matter what kind of work that you're doing. But the affluent population has such a high need for connection with people that they think are top of their game. And yeah. I would say that's one thing I've observed in the work that you do. So how about what the ultra affluent don't want?
Yeah, they don't want waste of time, as I was just kind of saying. So that can be a really long email. It can be a long meeting that's wasting their time. It can be, you know, a bunch of, frankly, text messages back and forth, like, stop wasting my time, pick up the phone and give me a call and give me an answer. Mm-hmm. So I think being respectful of their time is important, and to keep that in mind. They don't want in a lack of accountability. So they definitely want accountability. When you make a mistake, and we all do, you know, recognize it quickly, own up to it, and explain how you're going to move forward. I think that is one of the, in some ways, hardest things for any of us to do. None of us want to make a mistake, certainly, but owning it and then so you can move forward is incredibly important. So delays is another one that I had written down. Delays is not always something we have control over, especially in these last several years with supply chain problems that we've seen. So one of the things I've seen one of our designers do with a big client we're working on in Aspen with is she really tried hard to stay in front of any possible delay that she could comprehend might happen so that she could relay that to the client and let them know, you know, hey, we were told 3 weeks ago that this rug is going to be shipped in from the Middle East, and it's still not here yet. And so we are concerned that we're not going to make our installation or whatever the case may be. But being able to arm the client with the real information so that they know that we're trying to be proactive, we're trying to prepare them for those delays that might happen, is something that I've seen to be, it goes a long way in continuing to build, you know, maintain the trust, but also it allows them to make a change. Like if they have, and this happens all the time, everyone wants to be in, for example, by Christmas or Thanksgiving. And oftentimes the build timeline doesn't line up to what we've been told or when the client wants it to be. So I know this has happened with your friend, you know, doing the project here. So the further out ahead of that you can get and let the client know, listen, you might want to cancel your 15, you know, family members coming in for Thanksgiving and push it to another date, the better off you're going to be.
Well, that just brings back memories. I think my fondest memory of doing design is when the manufacturer that was doing a sofa for a client couldn't get one fabric, so they wouldn't start the sofa. And we had ordered in April. And finally, she looked at me and she said, is it going to make it for Thanksgiving? And I said, no. And then she said, it will make it for Christmas Eve so that I can sit on the sofa with my kids and open presents. And she said, it will happen. And do you know that we had to FedEx the sofa in? I will never forget that in my whole life.
It's crazy. I mean, I kind of joke sometimes, not directly, usually to a client's face, but you know, these are first world problems. And I have actually had a client say that to me in reverse. They have said, you know, this is a first world problem. You know, this is a sofa. It's fine. You know, but that actually raises another really good question that I think you had that you wanted to talk about, which is, you know, what, you know, can the affluent be really unreasonably difficult or not? And you know what I've really learned and I've really observed is whatever a person's personality is, that is who they are. As Oprah used to say, you know, you're gonna notice and understand what someone is within the first 3 to 10 seconds, and that's it. And trust your gut when you see that, because in the cases where we've worked with projects that have become very challenging and we had second guessed ourselves and whether we take it or not. We knew that within the first minute, you know, and we probably should have followed our gut. But, you know, we all of us have the same realities of sometimes you need to take a project because your cash flow needs it or whatever the reason. So we can't always follow that ideal client as we would love. And I know that was one of the things that you actually helped us develop early on, which is what is your ideal client, which is really important to have articulated. But it doesn't always work that way. And so what I've just seen is, you know, when people are just gracious and kind, and that's just who they are, if they can be billionaires or millionaires, it doesn't matter, but that's who they are. And the flip side can be equally true. So I don't know that money necessarily changes people all that much.
I think you're right. I would agree with that. Well, now the other part of this, you have 25 people on your team. How do you train your team to deliver that level of service? Because it is definitely a different level of service.
It's a different level of service. You know, we're not building track homes, which there's nothing wrong with that. They've got a place, but that's not who we're working with. So one of the things that we have noticed over the years, and again, we are no spring chickens. I'm in my 50s and so is Rush. We have recognized that, you know, someone coming into our business, and we recently had someone come in who had been in the workforce. They weren't right out of college. There's a different element of empathy is the wrong word, but there's a different level of thinking and how you relate to people as you get older and have had more experience just dealing with people and dealing with life and learning on your own, like, what is a better way for me to communicate with this person? Or if you've been lucky enough to have a really good mentor, you know, they've noticed that a soft skill that you might need development in or help developing. And I mean, that's probably the best case for any of us as we go through work and the workforce. We are actually making a little bit of a shift in our company. We've got someone now here who really has expertise in helping develop people and develop their careers and helping them develop their soft skills, and in a really positive way. So we're excited about that. And I'm excited for the whole company as a whole, because I think having 25 people now, we're at the point where we really need someone who can focus on the people component and successfully do that. So one of the things I can give you an example, that one thing that we have seen that we've tried really hard to encourage, and again, this I'm probably not supposed to say this, but the younger generation, they are not as quick to pick up a phone and hop on a phone call. They will text, they'll email, whatever, direct message, but they just aren't in the habit of picking up a phone to make a phone call. Whereas, you know, Rush might come by and ask them how they're doing, and they'll explain the problem. And he'll say, well, did you pick up the phone and did you call them, the vendor, whoever? Or the client, actually. And they'll say, well, no, I've left messages and I've, you know, sent messages. And they'll call them together, and usually they can resolve the issue within like a minute or two. So that's one example of areas where we try to explain why maybe doing something, handling something a little bit differently, maybe it's old school, if you want to call it that, might be more effective. But everyone's different too. And we recognize that. And not every client, not every vendor likes to respond the same way. So mm-hmm. I think it's understanding communication. One of the key questions we ask in our onboarding meeting with a client is, how do they like to be communicated with? Do they prefer a text? Do they want just emails? Do they want a phone call? And that's a really important question to establish right up front. And it's an easy question to ask. So,
great. Now let's talk about marketing, because marketing is different. And I know you've invested a lot of money over the years in marketing. And of course, one of those things that always comes to mind is the coffee table book that you sent me, which is beautiful. And and I would assume that has been a really good tool for you in the level of things that you're doing now. What other marketing strategies besides that?
Well, yeah, you're exactly right, Gail. Thank you. The book has been a great calling card for us. It's I'm excited to say it's in sixth printing right now and wow. Has done really well. We're really knocking on wood. It keeps going. But Natural Elegance is, we're thrilled with it, and we're in production for a second book. But that notwithstanding, some of the other things that are the other elements or the other pathways of marketing that that we still find very helpful are varied. One of them is social media. I'm sure everyone would answer the same way. I mean, that's still a really great way to be out there. I just was talking to one of the designers the other day and they said, yep, love Pinterest. That's actually kind of making a comeback apparently. So those two, Instagram and Pinterest are big ones. I work really hard to outreach to local and regional architects, brokers, builders. Aside from existing clients being referral sources, those three areas are really important to develop. And that's something anybody can do. You know, every town typically has any of those three categories of folks to build relationships with. And the other is local and regional magazines. When we moved from New York, one of the thoughts that we tried to clarify for ourselves was, you know, do we want to be a little fish in a big pond or a big fish in a little pond? And I mean, not that Jackson's a little pond, but it's not New York. And, you know, we have at least 20 plus interior designers now in Jackson, I believe, at last count. It's a lot for a town of 15,000 people. But there's a difference in the way that you can, you know, have visibility and become a little bit more known rather than in the bigger cities where you're constantly up against, you know, however many, you know, dozens of other designers it might be. So for me, for us, it's important to develop relationships with local magazines, regional magazines, get to know the editors, get to know and support them. You know, they rely on sponsorship through advertisement. So it's not that you're buying, you know, a way into their magazine, but you're certainly getting on their radar. Mm-hmm. So that there's nothing wrong with that. And they expect it, you know, they expect those relationships. Mm-hmm. So those areas I think are social media and local professionals, regional professionals, and then the magazines to me are probably the three other areas outside the book that we've focused on.
Mm. Okay, great. As far as budget, we should talk about this because some people might think, oh, you're dealing with the billionaires and the centimillionaires and these really high level people, but I don't think it's true that they don't care about budget. How do you talk about money with your clients?
Well, this is something that you taught us up front. You got to talk about and become comfortable with talking about money at the beginning. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you travel by G5 or Volkswagen. Everybody has got a budget. They really do. And one of the reasons that, you know, billionaires are as wealthy as they are is because they watch every penny. Mm-hmm. So they are not interested in wasting time, which is money. They're not interested in necessarily paying, you know, saying, you know, sky's the limit, because we've had that happen and it actually is not the case.
Never.
What seems to resonate is when you're talking about the interiors, I'll always say, you know, we don't have to have the top of the line unless you want it in every room of the house. We like to blend things. And I think every designer probably does this. Your key areas, you know, the public spaces, like the dining room, living room, master, probably the media room, you know, those areas really are where people are going to be the most. And you want those to be not only beautiful, but also very good quality. So they'll withstand, you know, a lot of use. The guest rooms or the kind of the secondary or tertiary rooms typically can take it down a few notches in terms of their budget. But it's always a blend. And there's very few cases where a guest room, in our experience, is at the same level as a master. So talking about the budget up front, I think most design firms these days will do a preliminary budget at the beginning. That's important. Even if it's based on, you know, imagery that you're looking at together, pretty much anyone in the industry can look at probably an ad or an editorial in a magazine and be able to identify, oh, that's this vendor and that's that vendor. And I can tell you the difference in prices right off the bat and why. So having that industry knowledge is why they're hiring us. At the same time, explaining that up front is equally important. So yes, you're right. There are budgets, they do exist. And I've heard of very few projects where they're unlimited.
Right, absolutely. Well, of course, at this level too, you're going to have challenges with this level of work and with running a firm at this level. So talk to me about some of the bigger challenges you've had to overcome over the last years that you've been in business.
Well, I don't think I'll be unique in saying what I'm about to say, and I'm sure most everyone listening is kind of rolling their eyes and said, oh yeah, we've been there. So meeting clients' expectations, especially in the last several years with timelines, has been one of the biggest challenges. Being in Jackson, we are, from what I understand, talking with design firm owners in other parts of the country, we are all challenged, but we are especially challenged. We have projects that run a year, even a year and a half, timeline-wise, over the original budget of time. So that's been a big one, and trying to help people set people's expectations. And one of the things that I have found that we end up sometimes being in the role of is trying to be the ones that have to deliver the bad news. And sometimes what we've realized, I think a good form of practice is to get with your professional team at the very beginning. So the architect, the builder, and the designer, get around a table and just say, hey guys, we all need to be, and ladies, we need to all be on the same page about how we're delivering information about timelines to our client, because we need to be together on this. And if you can have that conversation at the beginning of a project, when you get 2 years down the road and that contractor is telling you, we are not going to be in for Thanksgiving, we are not going to barely even be in for Christmas, it's probably going to be Easter, you need to all have figured out how to communicate that to the client. Because it should be the contractor, because they're the ones that are driving that timeline. But we've been in cases where we've been the bad guys. We've been the ones having to make that announcement because we can't get everyone else in the professional team to talk about it. And that can cause some heartache and some bad feelings. So I think it's always important to have a really great level of trust and communication between your professional team. I think of it as it's kind of a triangle, but you've actually got a fourth. You've got the builder, architect, interior designer, and landscape architect. And that foursome should really be a united front. And I have found with those projects, when that happens, it's so much more seamless. There's so much less frustration and a lot less missed expectations by the client. So that timeline thing has been a big challenge for us.
Understood. Well, let's wrap up this segment with three takeaways that you'd like to share.
Well, I have to give you credit. Some sage advice you gave us years ago was about growing your business, was to try to always make sure you're focusing on your best skills. So if my best skill is design and I hate trying to go out and get new business, or it's just not my thing, you might have to do it at first, but as soon as you can, get someone on board who can help you with that and really fill that other seat. They might be, and that other person, the second thing, right person, right seat. This comes from the whole EOS system that you got us on. So you might have someone in your company that is absolutely the right person for the company. They've got the best alignment to your core values, but they're just sitting in the wrong seat. So identify, instead of getting really angry and frustrated, trying to figure out like what is their best seat and their best use of their skill sets and moving them into that when it's possible. That is so much more powerful than trying to rehire and do it all from scratch. So right person, right seat is a big one. A third one, I would say just stay true to your vision. It's funny when I look out at all the designers now in magazines, and there's just so many of us now. Each keeping true to your voice and to your point of view for your design aesthetic, I think is really important, and not trying to just be a copycat. And I'm not saying that anyone would do that necessarily, but I think staying true to your heart and soul of what you love to do is so important, and stick to it. Stay laser focused.
Love that. Well, thank you for this. And I look forward to our next episode, and we're going to talk about technology. So
I can't wait.
For all of the listeners, be sure and check that one out with Klaus. He is known for his knowledge of technology. So check out that next episode. Thank you, Klaus.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great today. Thanks.
So is your firm ready to handle affluent clients? If not, hopefully Klaus's advice will help prepare you. Stay tuned for the final episode of Season 8 of the Creative Genius Podcast next week, where returning guest Marty Fonke comes onto the podcast to discuss selling and valuing your business.